is on the top stories. China urges the U.S. to stop what it calls its arbitrary suppression of investments after Washington banned firms that support the Chinese military. Far-right groups and counter-demonstrators plan to hold rallies at the U.S. Capitol amid tensions over the outcome of the presidential election. Also ahead, Russia and Ukraine register their highest number of daily coronavirus cases since the beginning of the pandemic. Welcome to the program. Our top story this hour, Beijing has urged Washington to stop banning U.S. investments in firms linked to the Chinese military, calling the move arbitrary suppression. China has accused the U.S. of what it called viciously slandering Chinese military civilian integration. China has pledged to uphold the rights and interests of its firms on Thursday. President Donald Trump prohibited investments in Chinese firms the U.S. says are owned or controlled by the Chinese military. Washington says the firms enable the development and modernization of China's military and directly threaten U.S. security. The ban marks the latest in tensions that have remained high between the two countries. For months now, China and the U.S. are at odds over a number of issues, including trade. Xingdou Xu, senior researcher at Pangol Institution, is joining us via Skype out of the Chinese capital of Beijing. Sir, it's good to have you with us. Walk us through, help us understand this issue a little bit better.
Well, for the United States, remember, you know, when you look at the China-U.S. relationship, now you always keep in mind the larger picture. The large picture is that U.S. sees the rise of China as a threat, as a challenge to its global number one status, to its global preeminent position. So the U.S., Washington people, they have this anxiety somehow to, you know, to sabotage or stop the rise of China. That's what they want. That's what the Pompeo and Trump, they want. That's their pursuit in their China policy, including the attacks on the Chinese companies. For example, Huawei, that's a private company. Hikvision, that's a private company. China Mobile, you know, China Telecommunication, they have nothing to do with the Chinese military. So even they have something to do with the Chinese military, that's a normal business. There's nothing wrong, and it's none of Washington's business. So you can see Washington is really doing something, you know, they talk about fairness, but when it comes to the ground, they do what they can to attack the Chinese progress. And secondly, I think Washington, in particular Trump, who is losing the election, are trying to create some trouble for the new administration and President-elect Biden. One way to do that is to create a lot of stumbling block between China and the United States. Even you know, Biden wants to see a stable relationship with China, that will become very difficult for him to do.
Mr. Xu, there is, of course, an incoming new U.S. administration, as you know. I mean, Joe Biden is getting closer to the White House day by day. How much of this do you attribute to the Trump administration, because you just mentioned that, to the policies of the Trump administration solely, which is not shared by the next possible U.S. administration under Mr. Joe Biden, and perhaps a betterment of the relations, including this thaw in relations between China and Washington?
Not exactly. I would say if there's, you know, when Biden presidency comes up in January, people in both countries would expect a stable relationship, a more rational China policy from Washington. Right now, you know, we have a regime in Washington which is based on complete lies. They live on lies and prosper on lies. And Pompeo and Trump, remember, not only internationally but also domestically. So yes, but Biden, you know, China to be tough. That's the basically a consensus from both the Republican and the Democratic Party in the United States. So nobody in Beijing expects a soft touch from Biden presidency. But anyway, that will be rational, but tough. At least you will be dealing with someone who is rational. You can reason with them. For people, diplomats, Chinese officials in Beijing, that's good enough. You know, at least it's predictable, it's rational. And right now you have a regime in Washington which is basically, desperate to hold on to power and do what they can to destroy, to damage this relationship with China. But, the companies they have been attacking basically are all high-tech companies. The U.S. understands very well, if they want to stop the rise of China, they want to damage the growth prospect of the Chinese high-tech companies, including Huawei. Mm-hmm. So that's why you take a look at the list of the Chinese companies. They are all in the high-tech sector, artificial intelligence and the communications. But again, China is large enough. The market is supposed to be the largest in terms of the retails next year, and the Chinese economy is supposed to be the largest one in 10 years. So no, Trump and Pompeo, it's just impossible for them to stop the rise of China.
All right, many, many thanks. That's Jingu Xu, senior researcher at Pangol Institution out of Beijing. I really appreciate your time. Political commentator David Barkin says the U.S. executive order has little meaning since all Chinese manufacturing companies that have contracts with the military are already blacklisted by the U.S.
I think that this executive order has relatively little substantial meaning because the defense firms, the large manufacturing firms in China that are engaged in contracts with the military were already on a blacklist in the People's Republic of China. So I think that I think that it's part of bombast. It's part of a group of people within the State Department and within the Department of Defense trying to assert that they are still in control while they're in a lame duck government. And I think that we have to understand it in the context of U.S. politics rather than in terms of the international repercussions.
China has defended the ousting of four opposition lawmakers from Hong Kong's legislature, saying the measure was the right medicine for the city. China's foreign ministry in Hong Kong said the expulsions will start a new chapter in ensuring smooth operation of the city's legislature. The ministry said the decision aims to guarantee that Hong Kong is governed with a high degree of autonomy. It also urged, quote, a handful of foreign politicians to keep their hands off China's internal affairs. Britain, the EU, and Canada have criticized China over the removal of the lawmakers. The three sides have already been at odds with Beijing over a security law that was passed in the summer. They say the law erodes Hong Kong's freedoms. U.S. officials have rejected claims of election fraud in the 2020 presidential race. Senior federal and state election officials said on Thursday that there is no evidence that votes were lost or changed or voting systems corrupted. They added that there are many unfounded claims for misinformation about the process of elections. The officials rejected allegations made by President Trump and Republicans that fraud and lost ballots led to his loss. The developments come after Trump retweeted a claim that an election equipment marker, quote, deleted 2.7 million votes for him nationwide and switched hundreds of thousands of his votes to Biden in Pennsylvania and other states. Trump's campaign has filed lawsuits to challenge the results of the election announced by U.S. media that projected Joe Biden's victory. National security analyst Brian Downing says U.S. President Trump will finally drop his claims of electoral fraud as his approach is doomed to failure in a democratic system.
Well, I would like to see the political processes go through. Trump is entitled to make his claims in court. There will be recounts in some states, but his bolder, more daring, more unbased in fact claims simply cannot go on with a democratic system. You're hearing more and more conservatives speak out against Trump and his supporters on this. Some of the media have turned on him as well. I expect that he will drop this. Supposedly his, maybe not soon, but I think say by mid-December or late December, well before January 20th, or even around the time the Electoral College meets in December. And as I said, I think he will be planning his next move, which will be a media and political movement.
Still in the U.S., more Republican lawmakers are calling on the Trump administration to stop blocking Joe Biden's access to intelligence briefings. Lawmakers include Senator Lindsey Graham, who is a key ally of President Trump. The call by those Republican lawmakers is seen as a tacit acknowledgement that Democrat Joe Biden will soon occupy the White House. That comes as Trump keeps refusing to concede defeat in the November 3rd presidential election. He says he has lost the votes due to electoral fraud. Most Republican officials and lawmakers support Trump's claims, and they say he has the right to challenge the election's results. In related development, far-right groups plan to hold rallies in the U.S. Capitol in a show of support for President Trump in the post-election dispute. Media personalities and white nationalists are among those planning the rallies for Saturday. They will be held under different names, including Million MAGA March and Stop the Steal. According to social media posts, all participating groups plan to gather at Washington, D.C.'s Freedom Plaza. Organizers have echoed Trump's claims that he lost the last week presidential election because of electoral fraud. Counter-demonstrations are also planned in the city for Saturday. Rallies have reportedly got no permission from the police. Now, a British charity says the country has witnessed record use of food banks between April and September this year, as the coronavirus pandemic has left many people jobless or tipped them into poverty. Earlier, we discussed that issue in our news review program.
In this edition of the news review, a British charity says the country has witnessed record use of food banks between April and September this year. The Trussell Trust said its half-year report shows there has been a 47% increase in need during the coronavirus pandemic. Britain's biggest food bank network said the six-month period was the busiest time for food banks, with over 1.2 million food packages distributed to the poor. The COVID-19 pandemic has caused Britain to experience its deepest recession. The country is the worst hit in Europe, with over 50,000 deaths. To discuss that further, we're joined by Mr. Keith Peltine, Professor of International Economics and Finance out of London, and also David Hearn, if I'm not mistaken, researcher and economist from the Center for Brexit Studies, live from Birmingham. Let's begin with our first guest, who is Mr. Keith Peltine. Professor, if you could please tell us what are the measures that the government can take to prevent such a surge in the need for people to go to food banks?
Well, I suppose you've got to look at the welfare system because you know, they increased the universal benefit by £20, but that will disappear in theory, and that's going to put a lot of people back to food banks. So you need a much more generous welfare system than we've currently got, because people don't go to food banks because they want to go to food banks to save money. They go to food banks because they're desperate.
And what are the measures, do you think, that the government can take to help them? Should the government offer more packages, stimulus packages, something to allow people who are not working at this point in time to be able to save up some money?
Yeah, well, the reason, you could give out food vouchers, of course. That's one thing they've been doing for the kids. They've reinstated that program. So that way, at least you ensure that they... people spend the money on the kids. Now, most of them do when they get the vouchers, you know, but they can also give them to someone else for cash. But that's rather minor. But the question is, why do people go to food banks? It's simply because they don't get enough income when they're unemployed. And also, the social security system doesn't treat you very nice if you've got a part-time job. So many people have got, actually, and there's many people in jobs that are still not earning enough to feed their families after their bills are going up. So, you know, it's not just unemployed people that go to food banks. You know, increasingly, we're seeing people on low incomes, and they're having to pay tax as well. And maybe we shouldn't be taxing these poor people.
Thank you very much for pointing that out, Mr. Hearn. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, by the way. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it, sir. But what do you think the measures that the government could take are, Mr. Pelby pointed out that we could stop taxing these people at least.
Yeah, I think the measures that can be taken, the largest single measure, as pointed out, is to increase the generosity of the welfare system, to increase payments, both universal credit and from legacy benefits, would be the single largest measure that you could take to reduce food bank use in this country. So that would be the sort of number one on the list. The second looks at things like increasing affordability of housing, etc.
So, Mr. Hearn, what is your opinion? How far do you think this can go? And is it enough for the government to make sure that people are eating? Shouldn't the government be more responsible and try to provide jobs?
It's difficult to provide jobs in the midst of a pandemic when you're asking people to stay home. I can see difficulties, shall we say, with that element of policy. The bigger issue here is the root cause behind growing food bank use is poverty. It is as simple as that. So helping people move out of poverty is going to be the number one, the single most effective route to reducing food bank use. And there are a number of things the government can do to aid with that. As I say, the primary mechanism you can use, and certainly the most effective mechanism that you can use in the short term, is simply to upgrade the benefit system, to upgrade the welfare safety net, so that it is considerably more generous than it is at present, particularly given the difficulties of finding work in the current situation. And don't forget, there are a great number of people, several million in fact, who are in relatively precarious forms of work. One thinks of the self-employed and contractors, where if you don't work, you don't eat. It is as simple as that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Keith Pilbeam, Professor of International Economics and Finance out of London, and Mr. David Hearn, researcher and researcher of Economics Center for Brexit Studies. Thanks to both of you gentlemen for following us on this edition of the News Review.
Russia and Ukraine have posted their highest number of daily coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. Russia on Friday registered nearly 22,000 new infections in 24 hours. That brings the country's total cases to more than 1.8 million, making it the fifth largest in the world. Also on Friday, Ukraine reported over 11,700 new virus cases. That was an all-time record, pushing the country's total cases to above 512,000. Meanwhile, Germany recorded over 23,000 new cases, raising its tally to over 751,000. Confirmed infections in the Czech Republic have jumped to nearly 447,000 after over 7,800 new cases were reported on Thursday. Talks between the European Union and Britain on their future ties are undoubtedly difficult. There are a range of issues that are impeding progress. Now, the British government's position in the tough negotiations seems to have been weakened after the latest political developments in the United States. U.S. President Donald Trump energetically encouraged British Prime Minister Boris Johnson to get Britain out of the EU as soon as possible. If you recall, Trump has long been an enthusiastic supporter of a no-deal Brexit. Trump always talked up the special relationship between Washington and London, promising a fast-track free trade deal between the two sides. But things have been changing very fast in America. As you know, Trump will most probably have to leave the White House soon. Joe Biden has openly opposed a no-deal Brexit. For Biden, a trade deal with London might not be as high a priority.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Hear the sound of life flows. IRIB English Radio.
Iran today.
The UN arms embargo on Iran ended on October the 18th under the terms of Resolution 2231, which endorsed the 2015 Iran Nuclear Deal, or JCPOA. But like the US elections result, there's yet room to swear on it. Should President-elect Joe Biden take the reins uncontested, he will re-enter the JCPOA, and Iran will be able to buy and sell weaponry prohibited from 2010 without U.S. interference. But is it that simple? Biden will re-enter the deal if Iran recommits to its nuclear deal commitments. Iran started reversibly stepping away from those commitments only after outgoing U.S. President Trump trashed the deal. So recommitting shouldn't be a problem for this country once the U.S. has taken the first step and rejoined the JCPOA club. Once that sequence is observed, the problem will be solved. The question is, will Biden put the horse before the cart so that Iran can benefit from the arms sanctions lifting without nuisance? I'm Leila Faramayazi, bringing to you experts for predictions on Iran today. Make no mistake, the U.S. tried to prevent the lifting of arms sanctions against Iran and had ready by mid-August the draft resolution for the Security Council to vote on, but it failed to win the vote. It just didn't acknowledge the loss, characteristically, and continues to threaten anyone wanting to get into arms deals with Iran. Legally, Iran is free to openly buy advanced weaponry and sell its defense equipment to anyone looking for quality at a reasonable price. But the question is, will America today look to the rule of international law after 4 years of deal-breaking? Mr. Mohammadi of the Khorasan paper implies the U.S. has not much choice left.
It's still limited to words, and the U.S. has not put it into action yet. Nothing has happened to either prove or disprove it. No arms embargo shipped from or destined to Iran has been seized to conclude that the U.S. or any other country has applied arms embargoes against Iran. We have yet to see such a thing, but the arms embargo has been lifted on paper. The Islamic Republic is entitled within the framework of international law and other UN resolutions to export arms or to import arms from any country it desires.
When the proposed resolution didn't work to keep arms sanctions in place, the U.S. sought to trigger the snapback mechanism. This way, all sanctions, including arms sanctions, would just snap back into place. But again, that mechanism is a provision in Resolution 2231 of the JCPOA, and America is no member. It pulled out of the JCPOA in 2018, and the UN Security Council at large just wouldn't hear of reinstating arms sanctions on Iran. Mr. Afrahi is a political analyst with whom we've, like today, done several interviews at his home. The arms embargo against Iran has come to an end automatically by way of the JCPOA. Would you say that that will legally hold, or is the U.S. right to assume it has triggered the snapback mechanism?
It was a big failure for the U.S. The Americans expected the European allies to stand with them. Now, 75 years after the end of World War II, for the first time, the EU Troika adopted a position in total opposition to the U.S.'s and vindicated Iran. That has strengthened Iran's position in international forums. The U.S. can continue to fabricate any obstacle it wants, but Iran will continue to exercise its rights.
Mr. Khoshchesh made the effort of coming to Press TV studios to give us his take on our topic of the week.
Would you say that the lifting of the arms embargo will hold? Because it legally holds, will it really hold?
One of the problems with this JCPOA is that it's not respected by the Europeans and by the main parties that were to guarantee that Iran would receive its merits. So based on JCPOA and Resolution 2231, They need to guarantee that Iran would be provided with its merits and all the sanctions would be removed under the JCPOA, including the US, the EU, and other types of sanctions. So the UN resolution stands above all. So 2231 is more important than the EU rules and regulations.
In theory, Iran is now free to purchase anything from tanks to warplanes and naval vessels without the need for UN approval. Before this, it could purchase purely defensive weapons, including the Russian-made S-400 air defense system, if it desired and were left to its own devices.
There might be even better technologies or which could help Tehran, and which could change the balance strategically on the coasts of the Persian Gulf and in the sea. You know, there might be ship-to-ship, anti-ship missiles which are mounted in warships. In this area, I believe Tehran would be willing to buy something. With regard to air fighter jets, yes, I believe Tehran would like to renew its air fleet, which is very old.
Mr. Khanzadi is commander of the Iranian Navy. He gives us a little update on naval assets.
Every achievement in the Navy before the Islamic Revolution was totally dependent on mainly Western governments. Iran used to purchase equipment and vessels from them or receive their naval education. But in the aftermath of the Islamic Revolution, the Navy started its work by relying on religious teachings and revolutionary ideals. The Navy would have disappeared had it continued the same pre-revolution process. The Navy's stability following the Islamic Revolution is based on domestic capabilities.
Anyhow, Iran will not be going on a weapons shopping spree, as its Foreign Minister Zarif put it. It would rather procure a select advanced kit of smaller quantity but higher quality weaponry and weapon systems. Because its focus is on producing its major defense needs at home. This is both cost-effective with an inflation of over 40% and serve to counter sanctions of 40 years. For Iran to freely buy and sell weapons is not a chance just for Iran. According to Mr. Khoshchashm, Iran expects JCPOA partners to both support this freedom and themselves deal in arms with Iran. This is because the JCPOA was to eventually boost Iran's foreign trade and economy. And should the European partners to the deal waver in showing commitment within months, Iran may do worse than mince its way away from the nuclear deal. So for events not to take such a drastic turn...
Do you see Iran getting to sell its domestically made armaments to its target market to the extent it expects?
That would require the foreign parties to the nuclear deal that have promised to do this arms trade with Iran to do it in 2 or 3 months. If they don't do it, then the parliament would go for that bill, as it was stated a few days ago. They confirmed and approved the single urgency of the bill. That means that was an alarm, that if this arms trade would not happen in 2 or 3 months, then Tehran, the Iranian parliament, would require the government to take action, to drop all undertakings under the JCPOA.
All said, matters are not completely in the hands of the U.S. alone.
How can Iran now sell its arms in light of threats from buyer nations? One option would be to smuggle arms. One option is to circumvent sanctions by selling arms to Russia, China, and other nations so that they would resell them to customers. Or we can share technological know-how. Just like civilian technology, we can share our military technology. Therefore, the U.S. does not enjoy too much freedom of action.
Iran learned to stand on its own feet, beginning with its abandonment in the early days of the Republic and during the imposed war with Ba'athist Iraq. This country's 2019 defense expenditure was under $18.5 billion. Compare that to Saudi Arabia's $80 billion.
Making military equipment at home means selling that equipment and military cooperation abroad to more than Iran's present 60 short customers. That would make for a pretty penny when the economy has been hit both by COVID-19 and U.S. sanctions. That's right, when Donald Trump backed out of the nuclear deal, which eased sanctions on this country, he reimposed economic nuclear-related UN sanctions as U.S. sanctions. And even now, America and its allies in West Asia can't be happy to see Iran at the gates of the global arms market.
The U.S.'s concern would be more than losing military ground to Iran in the region. It's also a matter of the big bucks.
As far as selling arms is concerned, one part of the story pertains to revenue that it generates for the country. The official arms market is valued at $500 billion. The unofficial market is much higher. They would never like us to have a share in this market. The second point is that we would supply arms to the countries that may not or cannot purchase arms from the US or Western nations. Apart from revenue making, Iran would upgrade some nations that may have to give concessions to the US because of military weaknesses.
Iran still faces the big problem, which is U.S. arms sanctions against this country continue, and the U.S. imagines those sanctions to be as good as U.N. sanctions. Now, should U.S. resistance and interference prevail, what will it mean for Iran, which is looking mostly to face off Russia and China to buy from? In a tweet October the 19th, Dmitry Polyansky, Russian ambassador to the UN, said, "It is not up to the United States to tell us or others what they can or can't do."
The issue of the arms trade is deeply intertwined with politics. You can never set aside politics from arms selling. You may separate wheat or even oil and petrochemicals from politics, but arms is entirely intertwined with politics. Every country would sell or buy arms based on its national security policy. We have held talks with Russia and China and have signed agreements with them on their air weapons, defense weapons and tanks. We don't need special weapons to a great extent.
Talking of the 10-year UN arms embargo that found itself enclosed by a sunset clause of the JCPOA, United Nations Security Council Resolution 1929, which was passed on the 9th of June 2010, banned Iran from participating in any activities related to ballistic missiles, tightened the arms embargo, travel bans on individuals involved with the program, froze the funds and assets of the IRGC and Islamic Republic of Iran shipping lines, and recommended that states inspect Iranian cargo, prohibit the servicing of Iranian vessels involved in prohibited activities, prevent the provision of financial services used for sensitive nuclear activities, etc., etc.
It's time to look at examples of weaponry Iran has and wants. But first, to look at what other media outlets have to say with Shahzad.
Hi, my name is Shahzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on the expiration of the UN arms embargo, Iran's approach, and opportunities. In an article by Critical Threats, we witness Iranian weapons exports will have lasting effects on regional dynamics. Iranian officials will try to make a net profit with exports by capitalizing on their expanding domestic defense industry. Iran invested in its defense industry after the arms embargo disrupted attempts to purchase vital defense systems since 2007. Iran started building the indigenous Balbar 373 air defense system in 2010 to rival the S-300 after Russia backtracked on a contract to sell Iran the system. Iranian media reports claim the Balbar 373 can detect three times more targets than the S-300 can. Iranian officials are likely preparing to sell weapons in Yemen, Syria, Afghanistan, and Mauritania. The leader of Iran's defense industry stated that Iran will sell its homegrown weapons to countries despised by the U.S. the day after the arms embargo was lifted. Iranian foreign ministry officials renewed diplomatic efforts in Yemen, Afghanistan, Syria, and Mauritania leading up to the expiration of the UN arms embargo. Arab News reports why it won't be easy to reset the Iran nuclear clock. On the political front, the Iranian administration has made it clear that it does not necessarily stand ready to re-enter the JCPOA, explaining that it negotiated with countries not changing U.S. administrations. The economic effect of U.S. sanctions may soften that stance, as may the devastation caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. As for the Europeans, they would welcome a revival of the JCPOA. The Middle East is the near neighbor of Europe, and as far as Brussels and other European capitals are concerned, the fewer tensions, the better. If a new U.S. administration chooses to re-engage on the JCPOA, it can count on support from the EU High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Joseph Borrell, and foreign ministries in London, Paris, and Berlin. Whenever one stands on the merits of the JCPOA, or lack of them, rekindling the spirit of 2015 will be difficult, to say the least. The Financial Tribune claims engagement with Iran in EU's strategic interest. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell underlined the need to keep the 2015 nuclear deal in place since engagement with Iran remains in EU's vital strategic interest. Together with our European and international partners, we are working hard to make sure that diplomacy with Iran continues to be possible, he said in his address to the European Parliament's plenary debate on the situation in Iran. While expressing concern about Iran's reduced compliance, Borrell pointed out that the nuclear deal is also an economic deal. We cannot pretend to ask Iran to fulfill the nuclear obligations if at the same time they do not get any kind of reward from the economic side, he said. He also said Europe would refuse to maintain a UN arms embargo on Iran now that it has expired as part of its JCPOA commitments. We cannot say that we fight to keep the JCPOA alive and at the same time impose an arms embargo related to the JCPOA itself, he said. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
Having come under siege from U.S. sanctions, Iran perfected weapons capabilities that mesh with defense tactics of mostly asymmetric warfare. It produces ballistic missiles and drones to create a tactical and strategic, primarily deterrent response. Iran also has, from tanks to artillery, to mortars, to anti-tank weapons and vehicles, to submarines.
In our talks with knowledge-based companies, a young engineer came and said he would repair the boat engines, which are very sophisticated. We gave him one sample, and after 2 months, he returned. Every time we sent this engine for repair, it was returned at 60% efficacy. But this time, when we put it on the test bed, we saw its efficacy at 85%. He stood firm and asked us to raise it to 100. After that, we gave him 3 engines, and this time he returned them in 1 month. 4 months later, he came and said he was ready to totally manufacture this engine for us. You see, that over a 5-month period, a knowledge-based cell comprising Iranian youth did this job. I can't name them now, otherwise you would be surprised to see people of such young age have reached such capability. It was just an example.
You know, drones are the future, are the first sample and generation of future arms, because future wars would be fought with robots or semi-robots, and Iran has the access to that. One of them is the Sentinel 170 that Iran developed after it downed the American Sentinel. It did a reverse engineering, reproduced it, and upgraded it. The American type was good only for surveillance, but the Iranian type does both surveillance and combat missions.
Since the 1990s, Iran has reverse engineered and in some cases improved Soviet and North Korean ballistic missiles and U.S. manufactured cruise missiles. It is also producing anti-tank guided missiles, mortars, radar systems, and so forth. In fact, this country claims to be a global power with radar and UAVs and has improved its air defense systems. It will, however, still need a variety of components from abroad, such as gyroscopes for drones.
اولین هدف است.
The first objective in buying arms is deterrence, not defense or war. The adversary party should know that you are equipped with such a system so that it would never dare attack you. For as long as you don't have such equipment, enemies will always think about attacking or invasion. But when you have it, you're safe.
Iran's major weakness is air capability. Because it exhausted its Air Force fleet during the Iraq-Iran War of the 80s in a heroic counterattack that pushed Iraq back at the onset of the war. To replenish that, Iran may find a number of the world's most proficient aircraft could be available for sale. They may be not as advanced as US or European fighter planes, but the Russian Sukhoi Su-30 Flanker combat jet, along with China's J-10 Firebird and the joint China-Pakistan JF-17 Thunder multi-role jets, are available for export. Lacking as Iran's Air Force might be, as Aero Society put it, as quaint as those Tomcats may look, with motivated pilots and good GCI, they might just prove to have unexpectedly sharp teeth against an adversary with a risk-adverse approach to an aerial conflict. And Iranian pilots proved to be pretty motivated during the contemporary war of the 1980s. The US may be the world's number one arms exporter, but as soon as a missile is suspected to be made in Iran, the unrivaled America will brand it as aid to terrorists. The US does know a thing or two about terrorists. To name some good customers, Iraq signed a $200 million arms deal with Iran in 2014. Syria and Venezuela may be able to ignore Washington's threats to all those dealing with Iran, but they will have difficulty paying for Iranian-produced weapons. Iran may also increase its munition, mortar, and light arms exports to Africa in making the most of the lifting of the arms embargo. Iranian military equipment suitable for regional allies and other customers include electro-optical and laser-guided missile systems such as the Sadid. This appears to be based on the Israeli Spike. Then there's Tondar, Qaem, Dehlavye and Tufan 5. That's a copy of the American TOW-2A. These missiles can be difficult to counter if used effectively. Iran has also begun manufacturing its own version of the versatile RPG-29 rocket-propelled grenade, named Qadir.
During the war with Saddam Hussein, Iran was not able even to produce one single bullet. Even barbed wire cargoes to Tehran were confiscated by the Ukrainians, by the Russians. They never allowed Iran to receive any kind of aid. So Tehran was pushed to develop an arms program. Now Tehran is self-sufficient. It is, you know, manufacturing different types of weapon systems, very advanced ones. When the Russians defied to go along with the terms of the deal over the S-300 anti-missile defense system, Tehran developed its own. And at the end of the day, they developed Bavar 373, which the Russians say is an upgraded version of S-300. It's called S-376E, which is a system between, you know, an air defense system between S-300 and S-400.
The U.S. remains unhappy at the prospect of a stronger Iran. That unhappiness, however, may work well for Iran if it translates into a change of stance towards this country. That is to say, if it keeps America and Israel away from Iranian sites. The two are banking on the weakness of Iran's fighters, but they may yet be surprised.
Our defense equipment, as much as they are upgraded and diversified, will benefit us. They can deter any limited airstrikes. Today, we have very effective defense equipment. Every country should upgrade its defense prowess and diversify and upgrade its arms.
The main purpose of U.S. sanctions is to make Iran defenseless by air, land, and sea for possible future attacks, and to weaken Iran to the point where it can take no offensive action. But a win-win situation is based on mutual relative respect for each party's interests. So perhaps with the Vice President of JCPOA, President Obama, now at the helm, the U.S. will ease its ambitions in favor of diplomatic talks it has long sought with Iran.
That's it for today. Bye for now.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on RIB English Radio with Brother Hussein, a book lover and a student of Tarbiyat Mudarris University of Tehran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, avid readers of books, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You've tuned into IRIB English Radio broadcasting from Iran. The show is Bookshelf, and I'm Hussein. I'm here if you're looking for a good book to read this week. Divine justice is a central belief in Islamic ideology, and of course, since everyone is looking to worship a Lord who is just rather than tyrannical, many expositories and books have been published on the subject of God's justice. It's also one of the main areas of arguments for atheists, questioning God's justice and moving on to whether God is complete or not, and thus worthy of worship or not. God's justice can be studied from different perspectives, one of which is the familiar issue of evil. Is it just for some people to be devastated by more evil than the rest? The answer to this question and similar questions must satisfy the mind. Since Islam is a religion for all cultures, races, and levels of human populations, our answers should be logical. Islam, after all, is the religion of reason. The Quran repeatedly reminds its audience that to find the truth, you must think. Our answers must be acceptable to those who think. If other ideologies have failed to appropriately address the topic of evil in regard to divine justice, we believe Islam has a convincing answer. Today we want to introduce a book about the most fundamental aspects of divine justice after a short break, so don't go away.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
You're back on IRIB English Radio broadcasting from Iran. This is Bookshelf. We were talking about divine justice and how it is central to Islamic belief and to the anti-theistic arguments of non-Muslims. Divine justice can be studied with several prisms. Today we want to receive help from one of the most prolific and most influential religious scholars in the last few decades, which is Murtaza Mutahhari. Today's book is called Divine Justice by Murtaza Mutahhari, translated by Suleyman Hassan Abedi, Murtaza Ali Dina, and Shuja Ali Mirza, and published by the International Center for Islamic Studies. Murtaza Mutahhari is one of the most influential contemporary scholars in Iran. He lived to see the Islamic Revolution but was martyred by a terrorist attack. Murtaza Mutahhari is a respected scholar known for his prolific publications, deep insight, and honorable methods of reasoning. So I have the book in front of me right now. It comes in 262 pages, and the contents include conceptual outline of the subject, discrimination, evils, benefits of evils, death, retribution, intercession, and good deeds of non-Muslims. After the break, we're going to read an excerpt from this book. I'm going to be reading page 81 of this book, which is about the secret of differences. You can download Divine Justice by Murtaza Mutahhari from al-islam.org and join us in the reading then. Stay tuned.
7 barometric pressure.
We come to you, and O God, name that thou art our only king.
Stay tuned to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio.
You're back on IRIB English Radio broadcasting from Iran. This is Bookshelf. We were talking about the book Divine Justice by Martyr Murtaza Mutahhari, which you can download from al-islam.org. And I'm about to read an excerpt of this book. I'll be reading page 147, which is about retributions. Reward of deeds. One of the issues that ought to be touched upon in any discussion on divine justice is the issue of the compensation for deeds in the hereafter. resurrection and the judgment of good and evil deeds, rewarding good doers and punishing evil doers, are in themselves manifestations of divine justice. One of the standard proofs presented for the validity of resurrection is that since God is all-wise and all-just, He does not abandon human deeds without reckoning and rewarding or punishing them. The leader of the faithful, Ali alayhi salam, says, "It is possible that God grants respite to the oppressor, but He never abandons him without punishment. He awaits him on the path of crossing and will block him, much like a bone stuck in the throat." Our aim in this section is not to establish the validity of the resurrection through God's justice. On the contrary, our present discussion will address the objection and argument raised against divine justice as regards the manner of punishment and retribution in the hereafter. It is claimed that the punishment in the hereafter, as it has been described to us, is contrary to divine justice. It is said that in the retribution of the hereafter, there is no correspondence between the crime and its punishment, and hence, the retribution is meted out unjustly. In this argument, the matter of retribution, which is otherwise an evidence for divine justice, is presented as an objection against it and as being contrary to wisdom. The idea, which is at the root of the objection, is that in the legislation of retributive laws, there ought to be a correspondence between the crime and retribution. For instance, if someone were to dump litter on the thoroughfare, justice demands that punitive action be taken against him. There's no doubt that the penalty for such an offense cannot be a heavy punishment, like execution or life imprisonment. Based on the principle of correspondence between crime and punishment, the penalty for such an offense can be, say, a maximum of a week's imprisonment. And if such an offender is judged in a kangaroo court and punished by way of a firing squad, it would constitute injustice. To punish offenses is necessary for justice, but if the principle of correspondence between crime and punishment is not observed, punishment would in itself be an act of injustice. Sins like backbiting, lying, adultery, and manslaughter are crimes which demand punishment, but are the punishments specified for them in the hereafter not excessive? The Quran specifies the punishment for manslaughter as an eternity in hellfire. For backbiting, it is narrated that it constitutes the condiment for mongrels of hellfire. Severe and unbearable punishments have been mentioned for other sins as well. Chastisements, which are qualitatively extremely intense and quantitatively very long. The objection is, how does this incongruity be reconciled with divine justice? In order to respond to this objection, we must discuss different types of punishments and point out the type that exists in the hereafter. This requires that we first study the order governing the realm of the hereafter and delineate the differences between it and the created order on the basis of what can be gleaned from reliable Islamic sources and logical proofs. The book goes on to speak about differences between the two worlds. Do the same physical laws, rules, and principles which govern this world also operate in the hereafter? Are there any differences between the life of this world and the hereafter? Is the realm of the hereafter the same as that of this world? I can go on and on. This is a very exciting book. But unfortunately, I don't have the leverage of that amount of time. What we were covering today was a book by Martyr Murtaza Mutahhari. The book is called Divine Justice, which you can download for free from al-islam.org. It's been translated by Sulaiman Hassan Abedi, Murtaza Al-Adina, and Shuja Ali Mirza, and published by International Center for Islamic Studies. If you missed this program, don't worry, you can always download an archive from our website. Simply search IRIB English Radio Bookshelf. Until next week, and a lot of reading. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.